Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Tara Moore, a part-time instructor in English at Penn State University, York. She is the author of two books, Victorian Christmas in Print and Christmas, the Sacred to Santa. Those books are rare in that they are both incredibly informative and really delightful to read. Tara, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to speak to you about Christmas.
Yeah, I really have to congratulate you on your book, Christmas, the Sacred to the Santa, and fawn all over it, because I talk up all the books of the authors that we get here on the show, but yours is really this blend of serious academic inquiry mixed with this joyful love of the topic, and that really comes through in the book. It also has pictures, which is great for me. So whatever possessed you to start writing on the topic of Christmas?
Well, when I was in grad school, I needed to come up with a topic for my dissertation, and I was spending time in the periodical section with old, dusty, bound periodicals, and it came down to Victorian nuns or Victorian Christmas. And while Victorian nuns might sound like a fun topic, when you start to read about it, it's pretty depressing. So I decided to go with the much merrier idea, and I'm so glad I did. It's been a great time.
Now, are you somebody who really gets into Christmas? Because reading through the book, I have that sense. Or is this just simply a sterile academic topic?
Well, I think that researching Christmas has allowed me to enjoy it to it's a deeper thing for me. But it's also caused me to be constantly evaluating what my family does at Christmas. So I think I don't know that I'm overboard in my Christmas celebrations, but it's very special to me.
Mm-hmm. You're not one of those people who has 50,000 lights lighting up the home, do you?
No, because of my focus on the historical Christmas, I'm much more interested in the low electricity versions of decorating and the more 19th century style Christmas.
Okay, you're not putting candles on a real tree, though, because that's a fire hazard.
It would be a fire hazard, right. And our Christmas tree is I have three children under the age of 10, so it's one of those very kid-friendly trees.
Oh, that's great. And the other thing is, growing up with an academic in the household can always be a challenge, especially for kids. So when you're going through the Christmas time celebration and putting up everything, are you giving your kids constant lessons and they're always going, "Mom, would you stop that?"
No, I do try to maintain the traditions of Christmas for them, something they can look forward to every year. But I did drag them. I live in Pennsylvania, and I drug them to there's a German historical museum nearby where a Belsnickel dresses up and visits people. And he's kind of a terrifying figure for a four-year-old, and so my children were traumatized for a little bit after visiting him. But it was in the name of history, so they had to get pictures.
Okay, that's something else. Now, your book explores the tension between the important and solemn religious elements of the holiday and also the secular aspects that have become attached to our contemporary celebrations. Are you someone who cherishes both of these to some degree, or do you favor more the secular or the more religious? What's your mix here?
Well, in my family, we do try to celebrate the Christian reason for Christmas. And so we have, you know, the Christmas tree and other parts that are much more secular, but we also in the past have used the Jesse tree, which is a more recent Christian tradition to remember the different scriptural support for leading up to Christmas. And we also do different Advent activities that focus us on scripture and on the Christian tradition. So, and also we participate with our church events. So I think that's the thing that I try to protect and I cherish, but I also enjoy, you know, the rest of the hoopla of Christmas too. I can see them as being, you know, different parts of something that our culture, you know, embraces.
Yeah, this is a great time of year for all of that kind of stuff, and I try to keep in mind the solemn elements of the religious holiday, but it's just a fun time. And as I think we go through the history of this, we'll see that it has been celebrated both in solemn tendencies, but it also has been celebrated with raucous hoopla in many cases. So one thing that I actually enjoy engaging in both aspects of those. Now, can I ask a little bit about your religious background, if you're good with that? Did you grow up religious or?
I grew up in a Presbyterian church, and I'm married to a Presbyterian pastor, so we are very involved in the life of the church and seeing how that's, you know, changing over the last decade. That's a big part of my life.
And so are you the consultant at the church for all the Christmas stuff and setting up the decorations?
Well, I can tell you this. I sort of feel like I should be, but I am very glad not decorating. Only like this, I can comment on historical choices.
But, okay.
And our church did. I was a little too timid to bring this up when I first got there, but there was a play written about the first pastor who came in 1774, and they wrote a play about his first Christmas. Well, Presbyterians that early time, they would not have been celebrating Christmas. So I was acting in the play, thinking this is not historical at all, but. It was more the celebration part that was okay and fun. But no, I don't do the decorating.
Okay. Well, speaking of history, let's go back to the beginning. And I have to note how ironic it is that Jesus was born on Christmas. I mean, how lucky is that?
All right. It would be perfect if we knew that were the case. There are a lot of details that when you really look at the date and how the church fathers initially came up with it, that we find that it was much more a symbolic choice rather than any hope of being accurate. So if we were being accurate, we would probably figure that that Christmas would take place in May or April, because that's when the shepherds are in the fields watching for the lambing season. And in December, that's not the case. So these shepherds who get to greet the angel, the angelic multitude, we're probably doing it in the springtime, in the early springtime in Judea, not in December. So that's one thing that tells us that there's probably, you know, a discrepancy with the actual date, but the church fathers, when they finally got a chance to decide when Christmas would be, they were deciding it was 300 years after the birth of Christ when they finally got a chance to sit down, and you know, they weren't being persecuted anymore to the extent they had been, so they got to decide, oh, we should really figure out when we want to celebrate the birth of Christ. So the reason they decided with that December, they went with the December 25th date, was because they backed it up. They needed to decide when would the Annunciation have happened. And so they figured that the most fertile time of the year in their mind was in the spring, and it was that spring equinox, or March 25th. So they decided to schedule the Annunciation for then, and once that occurred, then of course they figured Jesus's gestation period would have been perfectly 9 months later, and so he would have been born on the winter equinox, which used to be scheduled for the 25th of December. Things have shifted a little bit in time, but that's what they came up with. And another reason they decided to go with that date was because in the midwinter season, other non-Christian religions were celebrating and had a really festive attitude. So this would allow the Christians to also join in their wider culture and be celebrating at a time when it was, you know, people were taking a break from work for several days and were feasting. So just like this was during the time of the Calends and the Roman Saturnalia, and also a previously Persian celebration of Mithra's birthday. But this was all being celebrated around the Christians, and they thought they would, you know, that, so that was just an extra, I guess, bonus to scheduling it for late December.
Yeah, that's interesting how you present it that way, because I know a lot of people who talk down the historical parts of Christianity and often mention that, well, December 25th, that's just a pagan holiday, you know, the winter solstice right around that time. But it's interesting that you bring in the church fathers thinking about when the Annunciation would be and then calculating roughly 9 months hence to come up with the December 25th date.
Right, yeah, and I think that so much we've had to try to figure things out from what's been offered through the scripture. So I think they did they pretty much did the best they could, and they were juggling a lot of different issues and, you know, and awareness back then when they made the decision. And about 336 is when Rome first, the church in Rome first decided to celebrate it, and then it wasn't really declared a universal Christian holiday until 350. So, and it was kind of spreading slowly. And, it, you know, the communication back then wasn't that easy, too. So for the churches to make this decision and the Pope to come in and just declare it, it took some time.
Yeah. Does it really matter to what degree that we get the day correct? It seems that in terms of this holiday, Jesus is bigger than one particular day. So it's really the message that God is in the world is more important than the specific calendar day.
Oh, I agree. I think it's something when the early Christians decided that they wanted to celebrate it, they had a good cause to, and I think we still have good cause to continue that tradition.
What about the other parts of the birth narrative? Historically, what do we know about the trip to Bethlehem from Nazareth, and what about these wise men that we see in the nativity scenes nowadays?
Well, we know that it was an intentional choice that Mary made that trip. She didn't really have to go, but she was probably, I can imagine that because of the stigma attached to her pregnancy, she probably, you know, saw a benefit to getting out of town and to stay with her husband at that point in time. With the wise men, you know, she would have given birth, but the wise men would not have been there at the same time as the shepherds. So many of these nativity scenes, and I know you'll see the infant Jesus in the creche and the wise men standing around with the shepherds. Sometimes it seems like this great picture of social harmony, the shepherds and the kings from the east. But when we look at the setup of the first Christmas, those two groups would not have come together at all, because the shepherds were told that night, but the wise men, if they saw the star appear that night, then it is unlikely that they must have gotten there rather about 2 years later. So if you see a picture of the wise men offering gifts to a toddler Jesus, that's a more accurate display of their visit and their arrival.
Talk about the celebrations in early church history. You mentioned that it wasn't until 336 in the post-Constantine church era that it was first mentioned as December 25th and then a universal holiday in 350. But what were there celebrations in the pre-Constantine church for the first 300 years or so, or was this not a very important holiday for Christians then?
Well, it's really hard to find evidence before that period. We have some pictures on catacombs that might be the nativity, but it's so hard to say. The records just aren't there. We do know that in Judea, birthdays were not important. So the Romans celebrated birthdays to some extent, but the common people in Judea didn't pay much attention to them, and they didn't celebrate them on an annual basis. So the fact that it kind of got lost or wasn't recorded makes more sense when you think about that. So we just don't have the evidence that they made, I guess they made the time to work up an official church calendar until they were done being persecuted and started to establish some, some standards and foundations of a church that was going to be more than just a local church body. It was, you know, more of a regional church.
Now, in terms of celebrating a birthday, we mentioned that 336, it was first mentioned and becomes a universal holiday in 350. Was there a special reason for introducing Christmas as a holiday because Romans were celebrating births, or some theological reason for it?
Well, when it was initially created, it was not much of a, it wasn't the type of Christmas we imagine now at all. It was very different. And I should mention, I found evidence when they first started being noticed in some of the large city churches. Another bishop stood up and said, "This newfangled Christmas, this isn't a good idea." He didn't like the fact that the church was starting something new. I think that often holds true with churches even today, but he eventually, I guess, his church decided to go with it. But, so it was much more of a time of preparation and focusing on, waiting upon Christ's coming as an infant, and it was a little bit more like a Lenten preparation, and that's how it continued for centuries. There was a time of fasting associated, not initially, not in those first celebrations in the 300s, but within a couple hundred years, it was a time of of abstaining from things and getting ready for the coming of the Christ child. And so the actual feast of celebration was kind of letting loose after a time of waiting and being a little bit uncomfortable.
That brings us to the issue of Advent, which we oftentimes celebrate with calendars today and count down the coming of Christmas. And when did the notion of Advent develop?
Well, so Advent was this, in the Western Church, Advent was a fasting time, and it had this long name, the Quadra. So it was a celebration of St. Martin. It didn't sound like a very fun time. Sometimes it was about 6 weeks, then it got shortened to 4 weeks. And this was about in the 15th century, the 14th century, that it was more of a Lenten period and a little bit more established. But I should mention that the Eastern Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, still sees what we call Advent as a time of fasting. And so it's much more of a Lenten period for them even today. So that Advent started to turn around, and they gave up on the fasting element in around, I guess, the 1500s, when they started to celebrate with food a little bit more leading up to Christmas, and so they got divided away with the fasting. And so that's when it became more of a raucous celebration, and I'm thinking specifically in the United Kingdom, the parts of it that celebrated Christmas.
Let's start talking about those historical celebrations, because a lot of the things that we talk about today, decorating trees, really wasn't part of the early celebrations. So this bishop who was complaining about this newfangled Christmas probably wasn't doing it because people were putting up reindeers on the roof of the church or anything like that. The celebrations emerge over time, and they develop in different parts of the world differently. So let's go ahead and start talking about this and focus on the medieval era to begin with. So we're talking 800, 900, year 1000. We talked a little bit about fasting, but there's also this element of feasting. And so how did this concept of celebrating Christmas and the lead up to Christmas develop during the medieval era?
Well, during that period, I'd say Christmas was still spreading throughout Europe. If it was starting in Rome and, the churches in Constantinople and around in those southern areas, it was only just coming to England a little bit earlier, but then Germany and Scandinavia in 800, and people were still just bringing Christianity to these countries so early. It wasn't a universal faith by any means. So Christmas kind of came along with these, with the spread of Christianity, but it wasn't an enormous celebration. There is evidence that there was a Scandinavian king, when he converted, he decided that everyone was going to have to drink beer on Christmas to celebrate this event. And that was almost a way of making Christmas and Christianity more palatable to his people, who were not all, longtime Christians, because that was a feature of their celebrations of other pre-Christian holidays. So he was making this claim as a way to, I guess, transition his people. And it didn't sound like a horrible thing for the people to follow along with.
Yeah, I can imagine if I wasn't a Christian and they were saying, well, here's this theology stuff. And then I would go, I'm not sure. But then he says, yes, but beer on Christmas. I'm like, I'm there.
Right.
So how else did this develop in England? So 800, 900, year 1000, 1100. How are the traditions starting to develop during this time?
Well, at this time, if Christmas features at all, it's not anything like we picture today. Gifts were not really being developed until even a little bit later. The first gifts were more food, and we do have evidence that, it was about in the 12th century, I think, that nuns in France started giving gifts to children on St. Nicholas Day. So that still wasn't Christmas. It was just more this time of in December, the Christian holidays in December. So, I guess if people had the ability to give food as gifts, it tended to be the wealthy giving parties and food for the poor of their community to come into their homes and share in the food wealth. But it wasn't a back and forth type of giving at all. And it's much more clear from the 12th century on that some of these food gifts were given. But that kind of came and went depending on the popularity of the Catholic Church. Because there was a time when, later on, certainly, but the Protestants started to try to stamp out Christmas and all mention of Christmas. because they didn't like the fact that the word Mass was in it, and they felt like this, the whole celebration was far too Catholic for them. And so, that's of course later, but they did what they could to kind of delete all mention of Christmas, even calling that day something different.
Yeah, I want to cover that a little bit later because you have a great chapter in your book called When Christmas Was Outlawed or Outlawing Christmas. Mm-hmm. The name, though, you just brought up the name, and that's interesting. You talk about Christmas, and there's a lot of controversy about the name today. A lot of people will sign cards or put up signs that say Xmas, X-M-A-S. Tell us a little bit about the name and how all of the naming issues arose.
Right, well, so we saw that it was being called Christmas. It's one word, but not sounding quite like Christmas. And it's referred to that in old, I guess this would be old English writing. In Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, they talk about it as Christmas. And so, yeah, it's that mass that's the problem for a lot of the people who came to be Puritans. But with the Xmas, the reason that this happens, and I've had to defend my use of it occasionally when someone says, I can't believe you write Xmas, but when you write Christmas as many times as I do, you don't even write Xmas, you just write X, because it's, you know, one of the word I have to write the most almost. And so in Greek, the first letter of the name of Christ, it kind of looks like an X. So when we write an X, and that's how the abbreviation came about. It was the first letter of Christ and Mass together. So it's a continuation of the word Christ. It's just in a different language and transmuted into our X.
Mm. So it's okay that people will do that today, and you're not signaling some kind of denigration of the holiday.
Well, I mean, if they're worried about connecting Christ with Christmas, I think they can use the Xmas if they want to. Sure. Okay.
Very good. And it solves things, as you say. If you have to write it a lot of times, that makes it a lot simpler to write.
Mm-hmm.
What about this issue of the 12 days of Christmas? Is that something that originated during the medieval era as a means of preparing? And I mean, it's a beautiful song today, the 12 days of Christmas, but how did that concept of 12 days come along?
Well, 12 days, it actually started on Christmas Day, and then it lasted to the Epiphany, which would be scheduled then in early January. So I think we, and on cable channels, they like to have the 12 days of Christmas running up to Christmas. But if they did it in the old-fashioned style, they'd start playing these Christmas movies on Christmas Day and play them then toward January 6th, the Epiphany. But the 12 days of Christmas, it was a time of preparation, and that for the big celebration on January 6th, it was a time of feasting, but also this is when there would be several, plays were being developed for the entertainment during this period in the court for the courtly people. And that's why we have the play Twelfth Night by Shakespeare. It was probably based on this tradition and the fact that this was a time when people were gathered together for celebration. And so in the Shakespearean period, they were working up toward Twelfth Night. We know that Queen Mary of Scots, even though she's up there in Scotland, they were also looking at Twelfth Night celebrations. And it was a time when it wasn't just a one-day celebration, but crazy things could happen during this time. So we have evidence in about this topsy-turvy, what they liked to do back then. It's before TV.
Mm-hmm.
So they liked to dress people up in things that didn't make sense for them to be dressed up in. So Mary Queen of Scots would dress up one of her maids as the queen, and they'd treat that woman as the queen, and then Mary Queen of Scots would have to pretend she was not queen for a while, and they thought this was hilarious. But also in the churches, and especially the cathedrals where there were boys' choirs, the boys would select one of their own to become a boy bishop. And we have evidence of this from 1222, especially in Salisbury Cathedral. It's tough to get any kind of really concrete facts about large-scale participation because of the records, but we know that it was happening there. And so the boy, the choir boy, and it seems like this was just asking for trouble, would dress up in bishop's clothes, would lead services, write his own little sermons if he wasn't forced to give the ones that the adults wrote for him. But he also had a chance to travel for weeks and stay at the houses of the wealthy patrons of the cathedral and just kind of pretend like he was a bishop for everyone to kind of laugh and play along with. And I liken this to when I went to college, the college president and the faculty served us a Thanksgiving meal every year. So all the students had a chance to sit in the dining hall, and our faculty members would come serve us food, we just got a kick out of it because it was unique and topsy-turvy. So I think that's what they played it a lot longer because it went on for weeks.
I found that to be an absolutely fascinating aspect of the book, and I didn't really realize that was going on. You think of the medieval era being very hierarchically organized, but again, for a couple weeks, everybody reverses roles. And it must have had a very important social function of ameliorating conflict between individuals.
Oh, right. We hear that the adults kind of grumbled about it. You know, they put up with it, but they didn't like the fact that the boys were getting this power. And it went to the point where the boys' choir would take the best seats in the cathedral, and the leaders of the cathedral would have to sit in the choir. And, you know, you can just imagine the boys really enjoying that. But I think eventually the adults, I guess there's evidence that it got out of hand, or at least Henry VIII thought it was getting out of hand because he forbade it. And I thought that was really unique coming from him, but he just thought it was too wicked and it wasn't respectful. And so he decreed it shouldn't go on. So it did pretty much die out. I think the adults were okay to see it go, and the boys probably just had to let it go. Occasionally, very rarely, it's been tested out at British choirs in the 20th century at least, but I don't know that anyone's brave enough to go forward with it and really make a big deal out of it now.
You mentioned a lot of raucous behavior that is occurring during this period of time, and again, there's the solemnity of the holiday, but back in the day, back in the medieval era, this was pretty much a big, huge party time. Tell us about some of the raucousness that went on.
Well, right. We have this idea that Christmas is a holiday that focuses on children and the family, but that's entirely a 19th century production. It wasn't like that before that time. And so it was much more of, you know, if you weren't in church fasting, then you were probably in the street going from house to house carousing. And there's evidence of this type of behavior in many different cultures, in Greece, in Germany, in France. There were different things that people did. Sometimes they dressed up, and this is how the mumming tradition happened. People dressed up in, you know, and even what they dressed in changed from country to country, but the fact that they were usually trying to drink alcohol didn't so much change. So they might put on, like, curling paper or just odd clothes and rags and try to disguise themselves and walk around. And it was called different things, but it did come to America when America was settled, especially we have evidence of it in Pennsylvania with the Pennsylvania Germans who brought it from Germany. And it got out of hand for the householders. Householders were complaining that, you know, people were coming in demanding snacks and beer, and it was just too demanding, too much to ask of the honest householder to feast these mostly, you know, young men walking around kind of causing trouble as they got drunker and drunker. So Philadelphia as a city made some ordinances to control it, which had been a centuries-old tradition here brought to Pennsylvania. But they said, okay, we don't want people going around at night drunk. So they decided to try to get everybody collected during the day. And this is eventually their ordinances resulted in the Mummer's Day Parade, which is so famous in Philadelphia. And it has been moved to New Year's Day, but that was because they were trying to control the troubling, like, random wanderings of groups of young men who were eager to drink.
Yeah, we think about that today, and your eyes pop out that this would have been a tradition during that period of time. Normally, we think of people going from house to house caroling, and that seems to be much more sedate. Yeah, we'll sing some songs for you, and maybe you'll offer us up some cookies or something. How did the practice of caroling come about? Was this an effort to tame the carousing young men?
Well, Christmas carols originally I think we call them more religious songs, or we would think that they do talk about, you know, the three kings or other Christian elements. But carols back in the original meaning of them were much more rowdy and full of, I guess, peasant life. So they were just songs and country songs kind of that were sung by people. They eventually, the carols that we have retained over the years tend to be the ones that please our sensibilities or please the sensibilities of the Victorians. So they did retain some of those really old carols, but a lot were being written by people like, well, the Christmas songs were being written by people like Isaac Watts a little bit later. And so we have lost so many of the songs about Christmas because they were just, you know, oral tradition. And what we've retained, you know, I think we're not going to lose these. We hear them so many times during the course of, of the Christmas season. But yeah, they're much more sedate and like cleaned up versions of carols than what was originally sung.
Yeah, I can imagine just the reenactment of some of these medieval celebrations of carousing and stuff would be kind of interesting to see some days. I don't know if anybody does that nowadays. It would kind of be a little bit religiously incorrect, I think, but it'd be interesting to see. How did these traditions spread across cultures? I know a lot of the influence of Christmas here in the United States has been influenced by England, but you had mentioned Pennsylvanian Germans. And so there, in Europe, there must have been a lot of different flavors to Christmas. And how did these blend or spread throughout Europe during the medieval period?
Well, yes, they as Christmas was being adopted by the different Christianized countries, it did, you know, they took on some of the attributes of the previous celebrations, but they also had really local, you know, really unique personalities, the Christmas celebrations in each place. So even in England, and this is what I know the most about, but in England there would be there was a little spot in Hereford where one of the Christmas celebrations would be you gathered together as a community, you went out to the barn, and you put a cake, a Christmas cake, or some kind of cake on the horn of an ox, and then you splashed the ox with beer or cider, and waited to see where the cake would fall when the ox shook his head to get it off. And that was their Christmas celebration. This is not one that lasted the test of time. And so I think mostly these little local traditions, they were pretty healthy until the advent of print media. So in the early 19th century, when that's when, you know, writing tended to cross borders a little bit more easily because of the price of paper and literacy, the literacy numbers in the countries. So that's when we see a lot of the smoothing out of Christmas happening, and it's largely following the paper trail. So an example of this that I just find fascinating is the child focus of Christmas. And this is when, Christmas had been, you know, mostly in some places a religious celebration, sometimes just a good excuse to go out and party. But Germany, Coleridge, the poet, was traveling in Germany and saw how the Germans were focusing on children and giving gifts at Christmas and making the hearth the center of Christmas time. And so he wrote about this, and it was printed for an English audience back home. He was writing in English. And they just thought, oh, this is a great idea. So slowly, following that, in the decades following that, the English Christmas started to become child-focused. And because America was pretty much absorbing and eating all of the print content from the United Kingdom because of, you know, they were not worried about piracy laws. They just took it wholesale and spread it all over America. They were absorbing the same kind of information about Christmas as, you know, and building that identity. So, and that's also, you know, later on we can talk about how these images of Santa Claus got standardized, but it was largely to do with print media.
Let's start talking about some of the characters and traditions about this. I'm going to start with the traditions first, not so much the characters, because Santa Claus is always one that comes up, and it's a fascinating one we've talked about before on this podcast. But some of the traditions that we associate with are relatively new and come from different places that we might not expect. The big one that everybody always thinks about is the Christmas tree, which is a pine tree. And again, I'm not thinking that there was a ornamental Christmas pine tree in Bethlehem during the time of the birth. So where did this whole idea of Christmas tree and decorating a Christmas tree come about?
Well, yes, the Christmas tree is such a focal part of our Christmas, you would think it would be easy to trace, but it's not. It's I spent a lot of time looking into it. And Christmas trees, it's, you know, there are some myths associated with them, and I think a lot of the, you know, the general tabletop books will use these myths to say this is where they came from, but I think really we have to say we don't know. What we do know is that the Romans decorated trees with candles and trinkets during their Saturnalia worship of the sun god. It's kind of a celebration of the sun god. So there was a very early connection between putting lights and pretty things on trees. but those were not necessarily pine trees. There were trees that figured into miracle plays during the medieval period, which was one of the few ways that people got access to gospel stories and Old Testament stories. But what we know is that Christmas trees began to be popular in the 1700s in Germany, and they could have been kind of a combination of different types of decorations people were using in midwinter period. And certainly there, you know, if you don't have much going on, you don't have these lights like we have now, the trees, the evergreens are offering a little bit of color during the Christmas time. But it doesn't seem like they were hugely popular until maybe the 1700s. And we know that authorities in Salzburg started to worry about the health of their local forests around the city and actually banned the removal of pine trees from these forests in 1755, just because it seemed to be a snowballing tradition. So there, the less trustworthy myths involve Martin Luther. Some people think that he brought one, a Christmas tree into his house to decorate during Christmas time, and since he did it and was such a father of the church, it started something. And other people make an argument that there's this tradition about St. Boniface, who was a missionary to Germany, that he redirected oak worshipers, these oak worshiping Germans, to evergreens as a symbol of Christ, and that's what brought them into the home. But it's hard to say. It's really hard to say what did it.
One of the things that I loved about your book is that you have a number of pictures about the season, and you also have little blurbs about odd practices that occur. And again, these aren't the typical ones that you see in most Christmas books. You really did your research here. One of the traditions I found fascinating is that some Christmas trees were hung upside down. Why was that?
Oh, they were. And I've seen this done at the German History Museum I've told you about, that's not terribly far from here. And it is striking. It's an unusual sight to see an upside-down Christmas tree. But the reason it was done was because at that time the Germans were decorating their Christmas trees with little homemade ornaments that were made out of basically a hard cookie. Not very sweet, but it would be hard. But it would be okay to eat eventually at the end of Christmas. But if you're just putting a tree in the middle of your farmhouse and have it decorated with cookies, then it's going to attract rodents like crazy. So they decided to put it upside down so that it's hanging there and they have it in the house, it's decorated, but the rats can't get to it.
I would think rats are pretty creative, though. They would climb from the top of the roof and down, but I guess this apparently worked. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned cookies, right? You're hanging cookies on trees, and I wouldn't. If a cookie got hung on our tree, it wouldn't last very long because I happen to love Christmas cookies. Where did that tradition arise, or do we even know?
Well, I don't know that we can say we know exactly one point that led to the popularity of Christmas cookies. I think it's just a part of feasting, and cookies tend to last longer than some other food items. So if you're baking it, they're around for a while. There are some funny stories about cookies and Christmas baking. We know that there were, I guess maybe it's more Christmas cakes, but there were people who traced, you know, if Christmas was being, I guess, the Puritans who were trying to stamp Christmas out sometimes traced the bakers. If they found a baker who was making Christmas treats, like cookies or Christmas bread, and they found them, then they would find the bakers, but they'd also try to get the baker to rat out who was buying from them. So they could go on and find those people for celebrating during a time when Christmas was not really welcome.
Wow. Wow. The dangerous underground economy of cookie baking.
Right. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite Christmas cookie, by the way?
Well, in my family, we make sand tarts, which are a butter cookie that my children decorate and make a huge mess, sprinkling sugar crystals on. But my daughters are already waiting. They're asking me, when can we do this? This week, I guess.
Okay, yeah, you got to get started early because eating the cookies. I like those ones with the Hershey Kisses in there, but I don't think that's a deep historical tradition that must have come out about recently.
Probably not.
And anybody out there that wishes to send me Christmas cookies, you can feel free to do that as well. Let's get into the characters of Christmas, because you do a wonderful job in your book about bringing a lot of these folks to life and talking about the origins of these. And obviously, Jesus is the reason for the season that we often hear, but there's a big supporting cast that has arisen over time. So let's go through those, most famously starting with St. Nicholas, not necessarily Santa Claus, but St. Nicholas and the relationship to Santa Claus. So tell us the story about these folks.
Right, so I was really interested to learn when I was doing my research that Nicholas was a real person. He was a bishop of Myra in Turkey. It's not called Myra anymore, but it's now called Demre. So he was a bishop who traveled to the First Council of Nicaea. That was an important council because they were deciding the date for Easter, and they were deciding whether or not Christ was divine. And we know this one little snippet of the real-life Nicholas was that he slapped the main proponent of the fact that Christ was not fully divine. So they got really into this debate to the point of blows. But so he was a real person, but there an enormous cult and a mythology has surrounded him once he was canonized. So he was. It was said that he would not breastfeed when he was a baby during the fasting days of the Catholic Church. He was just so devout, even as a newborn and as an infant. We hear more often that myth where he gave a gift of money to a poor man so that his daughters didn't have to go into prostitution or didn't have to go become slaves. That's sometimes said to be the beginning of the Christmas gift, although that's probably just more of a myth that surrounding him. But he sounded like a great guy, and he was a patron saint for a lot of different different workers who were very important to the economy of the 800s, the 500s. So the popularity or the cult of Saint Nicholas spread, and he was the most famous saint in the 12th century. He only was eclipsed by Mary, so he was really a popular person. He has his own Saint's Day, which is December 6th. And today, people in Germany and Austria and some other countries in Europe, they still celebrate St. Nicholas Day. They make a big deal about it. And he has, and I'm sure I'll get to talk about his companion shortly.
Yeah, which would be Santa Claus. And how does, or is that the companion you're talking about?
Well, no, I'm thinking there's a scarier companion.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we're going to talk about him in a second, the kind of the anti-Santa, I guess. But let's talk about Santa Claus. And we oftentimes think of Santa Claus as being jolly old St. Nicholas, and so there must be a continuous path between this St. Nicholas of Myra back in the First Council of Nicaea to this jolly old fat guy who wears a red suit. But that's not really necessarily the case. Who is the Santa guy?
Well, Santa is probably a development from the wild men of Europe, because there was a time when a lot of Europe became kind of anti-Catholic. They weren't comfortable with the idea of Saint Nicholas, and so he was almost censored out of existence, even at Christmas time. So instead, they turned to this wild man image, and that would be someone who's horned, grotesque, covered in furs, and each locality would have their own name for this kind of person, sort of like the hairy guy up in the woods, up in the mountains, who was scary. And he eventually came down, it just transpired that he became a gift giver at Christmas time. And so this kind of odd figure did turn, kind of blended with the figure then of St. Nicholas and the Santa Claus or the Sinterklaas, which is a Dutch word. And somehow they blended together to become what we now know as Santa Claus. But if you look at images of the very early Santa Clauses, and sometimes they're even called St. Nicholas back in the 1700s, early 1800s, he doesn't look like our modern Santa. He is skinny. He's much shorter. He's really more of an elf. And in most of the pictures, he's got a big nose that's blotchy, and it really suggests that he's drunk. So he might be on a rooftop, or he might have a sleigh. Not that he has the eight reindeer at this point, because that didn't happen until the 1950s. But he's smoking a pipe, and he really looks like a guy who belongs in a pub rather than someone who would be thinking about children, having a list for, children. So these ideas are blending, and when you see a representation of the St. Nicholas that you see in the European countries on St. Nicholas Day, he doesn't, he's much more, he stands straighter. He just looks like a more respectful figure than the Santa Claus, the early Santa Claus. But that all was then kind of got solidified as a concept then in the late 1800s when Thomas Nast drew the first Santa Claus picture that really captured the imagination of America and then got sent back over to Europe. And that was published in 1863. So it was just a black and white picture of Santa. But Thomas Nast made him merry. He made him, kind of rotund. But this figure was Thomas Nassen, as an artist, was influenced by his own European roots and the Bavarian Pelsnickel, which was a German gift bringer that developed from the wild man. So it is, you know, he was in America at that point, so he's blending all these different ideas as he does his famous depictions of Santa Claus. But if you think about the Santa Claus, that we still repeat this poem by that's attributed to Clement Moore. But we're told that in that poem, he was dressed all in furs from his head to his foot. Now, that's not our Santa today. Our Santa just has a little bit of fur around his hood, around his sleeves, but not dressed all in fur. But also it goes on to say his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. So in that picture, it was kind of a dirty, much more like a wild man who was okay with that filth and okay with the, you know, the furs. And so he did get cleaned up when Thomas Nast portrayed him.
And finally, too, we get a really nice version of Santa Claus in the early 20th century, around 1931, with Santa and a Coke and a smile, don't we?
Yes, right. So that color red was certainly, it was established before, but that just did it. So a lot of the gift bringers who had different names in European localities, they started wearing red as well. And whatever they wore before, now they are dressed in red. So there's Icelandic Yule Lads, who are a group, and maybe they don't resonate as much because there's so many of them. I think there's 7 or 8 who have names. They each have their own little pranks they pull on families. So they used to dress like medieval Icelanders, but more recently when they're depicted, they're all dressed like Santa Claus. So, and that same thing happened with the different European gift bringers. It got to the point where that American image of Santa became a little obnoxious to some people. I think it's still occasionally tough for people who aren't in America to handle, but the priests in Dijon in France really found it offensive. They didn't like how after World War II, when there's so many Americans involved in France and American culture was really influential, they were seeing this red-dressed Santa Claus figure who had eclipsed some of the Père Noël or the French Christmas figures, who were maybe much more in line with the Catholic celebration of Christmas. Not that they were part of the Catholic celebration, but they had always been there, so they were okay, but now there was a Santa Claus figure. So the priests in Dijon decided that they would burn Santa in effigy. So in 1951, they got a Santa suit, they stuffed it with straw, and then they gathered up 200 Sunday school children and decided this was the perfect audience for burning Santa Claus, and that's what they did. So, and it was very serious and mm-hmm. really a statement against the globalization of this American Santa Claus. I think it's really, really interesting because nothing we would do today. Santa is far too, he's protected.
Yeah.
You can't burn Santa.
No more burning Santa. I have to turn people back to your book, too, and urge them to purchase it because the pictures that you have in here are just wonderful. You get the different images of Santa, the wild man Santa, and then the happy coconut smile Santa, and all these different things. One that caught my attention were these Swedish trolls. Who are the Swedish trolls?
The Swedish trolls?
Yeah.
Well, in Sweden, I know I wrote about the straw goats they use in Sweden.
Yeah, that may be it, yeah.
And so maybe you are thinking of maybe you're thinking of the Nissa. I'm sorry. Yes, but in Scandinavia, so their gift bringers were these little Nissa, these little kind of house elves. So the elves they were pretty, I don't know, mischievous. And they weren't as sedate as maybe we see Santa now. Like, we know what Santa does. He brings a gift and he leaves. But the Nissa were, it was mostly male. Sometimes they had female Nissa as well a little bit later on. And so if you go to Scandinavia you get to see Christmas, then you'll see a lot of these as decorations. And they don't look so much like Santa, except now they have started to wear red. So I guess that's true. They've kind of taken on that little bit of like Christmas color is red now globally.
Well, speaking of mischievous characters, there is one that really stands out, and there's actually a movie this year that's coming out, a horror movie, talking about Krampus. Who is Krampus?
Yeah, the Krampus is he's a descendant of the wild man of Europe, and he was most popular in southern Germany and northern Austria. And until this movie, and I'm not sure what kind of effect this will have, but he was really limited to those locations, and they had retained him. So I'll just try to describe him, and I'm sure if your listeners could Google what he looks like, they will be so surprised that this figure is a Christmas figure. He looks like a demon.
Mm-hmm.
He has this like long, wookie hair, furry face, like kind of like looks like yak fur, and big, huge teeth, and enormous antlers. And the scary thing is that he would walk around with a whip. So he kind of became the, I guess, the bad cop of the good cop, bad cop combination of St. Nicholas and Krampus, because they do arrive together on St. Nicholas Day. They sometimes have Krampus pulling the sleigh that Nicholas is riding in. And whereas Nicholas is the, you know, supposed to be goodness and light, the Krampus is the threat that the children really must behave. And they would hand the birch sticks out to parents, especially children. They want to say, oh, you've been bad. Here's a birch stick. Parents, use it on your children. And, you know, my children were terrified of Belsnickel, who did not have hair all over him like this and horns. So I can't imagine what the Krampus laugh for if they have these parades then of Krampus, because Krampus is so fun to dress up as. Basically a midwinter Halloween scenario where adults put on different color Krampus costumes and walk through bonfire-lit streets, you know, hopefully it's snow-covered, you know, if possible, and it just is a very striking scene. So I have looked at the movie a little bit. I haven't gone to see it. I guess I'll have to see it at some point, but I don't really like horror movies.
Yeah, it is definitely going to be more of a Halloween movie, but a Halloween at Christmas time, as you described it here. In terms of all of these different figures, from these Scandinavian trolls to the wild man to Krampus, when did the Christ child become important once again in the Christmas season?
Well, the nativity was often there, maybe you know, in the background, but part of the very expected element of Christmas. I think it was in about the, I'm thinking it's the 1950s, 1960s, that the Knights of Columbus decided that Keep Christ in Christmas was a slogan that needed to be spread once more because of the growing commercialism of Christmas. So while people may have celebrated with creches, it just became, you know, an extra message about Christmas that, you know, to direct your gaze back to the Christian origin of Christ.
Yeah. One of the interesting facts about your book, or one of the chapters, I should say, is Christmas being banned or outlawed. And one would think, how could you ever ban Christmas? It's such a wonderful time. What is going on in that chapter? How did you come to write about that?
This is very surprising to us because we think that Christmas has been around forever. I think that's what we imagine, that ever since Jesus, you know, established himself, then people have been celebrating Christmas. But it's been a transition through time. And so because Christmas was so associated with the Catholic Church, which initiated the celebration, Puritans during the 1500s, the 1600s, I guess, the Puritans were identified Christmas as a problem for them. And they wanted to do away with the Catholic celebrations with the saints. They also wanted to do away with Christmas because of its association with the Catholic Church. And so this is happening. Even cookies of St. Nicholas were outlawed in parts of Austria at that time. And what I'm most familiar with is what happened in Scotland, which was really dominated by the Puritan Church, and how you know, they went around policing whether or not their congregants were celebrating Christmas. But also because England formed an alliance with these Scottish Presbyterians, it affected all of England. And so there was a while there where all of England was kind of, you know, Christmas was being silenced in England, which I think is also strange for us because as Americans we look back to Germany, we look back to England as like this wellspring of Christmas history. But it was not always the case. So people were not supposed to decorate publicly for Christmas. They were not supposed to even really, they weren't supposed to go to church on Christmas to celebrate Christmas, and it should not be mentioned from the pulpit that it was Christmas. They were not supposed to use that word. And so the Parliament, the English Parliament, intentionally met on Christmas Day for years, just to make the point, this is not a holiday, this is a work day, get to work. And so they would have soldiers policing the shops to make sure no one closed their shops at Christmas because it was supposed to just be a normal business day. And once the Long Parliament was over, once the monarchy was reestablished, that's when, I think that's 1660, that's when Christmas was allowed to come back. And it was a little bit weak at first because basically a generation, it had gone underground for a generation. But when it came back, it was that's when it got rowdy, especially in England, and had this really lively, big celebration, especially by the richest people in the land, and it did trickle down throughout. So that's the main story of it being outlawed, I think, that resonates with Americans, because that meant that the pilgrims who came to America, they also, had that mindset that Christmas shouldn't exist. So the very first colony in New England, from Europe, the European colony, there was a conflict between the strangers and the pilgrims. And the pilgrims said, we don't celebrate Christmas, but the strangers really wanted to take a day off and play soccer or kick the ball around, I guess, in the streets. And so the pilgrims tried to censor that. And it was a conflict between the pilgrim fathers, even as the early New England colonies were developing. And so that caused real tension. And it left a long tradition of the church ignoring Christmas. So the Presbyterian Church didn't do anything with Christmas. Quaker Church didn't do anything with Christmas. And it wasn't really until the 1900s when the Sunday school movement started to bring Christmas back into the churches. So for a long time, Christmas was operating outside the church, outside of these Protestant churches. Now, the Anglican Church that was largely down south, the early colonies, it was always, had a clear connection with Christmas, but not so with the New England colonies in America. But those stories, they resolve themselves. I think it's much sadder to think about how the Nazi regime censored Christmas and really tried to control Christmas celebrations in the countries that it was dominating during World War II. And even among its own people, this, we see Germany as this heartspring of Christmas, but the Nazis were really trying to change the message of Christmas and certainly take Christ out of it to make it much more of a celebration of the German folk and, if possible, Hitler. So they worked in some new Christmas songs. They took out Goebbels, removed the lyrics that had to do with Christ and anything religious, and instead they had German orphans singing Christmas carols that were all about Hitler. And they were instructing families to make cookies that were not, not cookie cutouts of anything religious, but instead Wotan symbol, which was something that the Nazis were trying to get back to that pre-Christian European tradition. Mm-hmm. And I think, and there's really great evidence, Joe Perry has written about this, that their goal was to, continue that, but they didn't have the chance. And so Christmas obviously did spring back in those countries where they had briefly been in power.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing that it becomes such a political issue you can see political regimes trying to control the celebration of Christmas, dating back to the early times when it was celebrated. It was a topsy-turvy period when the queen dressed as the maid and the maid dressed as the queen, and that can oftentimes be very upsetting. You had another aspect in the Christmas outlawed chapter that talked about slave plantations, that while there was an effort to Christianize slaves, there was a downplaying of Christmas because it could lead to rebellions.
Right, and this is happening in the British-held islands, specifically that's where this evidence is, British-held islands in the Caribbean, where the slaves were, they worked really hard. They wanted to take time off at Christmas time. They developed their own traditions based on this. Some of it had to do with dressing up within these really elaborate costumes. And so when slave owners tried to do away with Christmas celebrations for the enslaved people, because it was maybe 3 days off and there might be more time on either end of that, but that actually led to revolt. So it was very important to them to have those 3 days, partly because they needed 3 days to travel around to see family they'd been separated from. So it was so important to have that, they could count on that time during the year that they could travel, across to different towns, different places to reconnect with loved ones that they didn't have a control over to stay with. They couldn't do what they wanted. So Christmas was important to them.
I want to finish up here with the few minutes that we have left and talk a bit about the commercialization of Christmas. A lot of people today are very concerned about how Christmas is not really a religious holiday anymore, but it's a shopping holiday. You have Black Friday and Cyber Monday and then this holiday or this shopping day and that shopping day. It creates an interesting tension between the secular and the sacred. And that's a theme that runs throughout your book. And tell us a little bit about your thoughts on this issue of Christmas and commercialization today.
Well, my research did cause me to read a lot about studies that are done about the stresses of Christmas and the enormous amount of money that's put into Christmas. More money is spent at Christmas than some small countries even have in their budget. It's amazing. And there's a fascinating book. It's called Scroogenomics, that talks about the economy of Christmas and why we give presents and all the little things that go into our heads as we're trying to make choices about handing a present to somebody. Because Christmas presents are tough. You have to make the present, you have to decide on the present and exchange it simultaneously. It's not like birthday presents where you get a chance to say, well, this is what he gave me last year, so I'll give him something in the same vein. Christmas presents, it happens right at the same time, so we're always trying to, you know, maneuver and figure out what's going to be suitable for the relationship. And that's stressful. It's amazing how many people, or how many gifts, I guess, are just bought at Christmas time. But we think that America is the one spending the most money and giving the most gifts at Christmas, but that's not actually the case. America is spending a lot of money and giving many presents, but we're outdone by some other countries. We are giving, in America, I think it's about, we're giving $140 a person is what we're spending to give gifts at Christmas time, and that does sound like a lot. And there is a 25% sales jump in December, but we're pretty average in the developing or the developed world about how much we're spending at Christmas time. And I guess this real boost in the commercialism of Christmas has happened really since the 80s, the 90s, but it was a growing trend following the Industrial Revolution where gifts were store-bought gifts, and that just became cheaper and cheaper to hand over store-bought gifts. So it hasn't been like this forever. I mean, it was a slow build until the 20th century, certainly. Gifts were even homemade, you know, not that long ago, and that conveyed a different message than the store-bought gifts we rely so much on today. So what I have read is that it's a lot of stress, and often that stress is falling on the women in families. It doesn't seem fair, and maybe that's not the case in everyone's family, that they share that stress. That would, I guess, be better, but it's a little, I guess, just discouraging to see how that stress can worry people and cause them to not enjoy the fullness of what could be a really peaceful time.
Yeah, it's a great time that we bring together family, and as our family has matured, it's spending more time together and finding some quiet places. One of the traditions that we've done for several years is go up to a small town called Leavenworth out here in Washington, and just the weekend before Christmas, and just spend some quiet time where we just turn everything off and do some sledding or just walking around, and which we find to be very pleasant here. I have to ask before I reflect on some of your personal holiday traditions. You mentioned that Americans are pretty average on the amount they spend. Who's the highest spender out there?
The number that stuck with me, actually, I'm sorry, this isn't the highest one, but this was surprising, that Chinese citizens were spending $4 a person on Christmas. And that is surprising because, you know, Christmas is really new to China. It's just starting there. I mean, millions of people are now celebrating, but mostly on the East Coast and mostly in big cities. So the fact that that's the amount, and it's millions of people, and it's growing, and it's an entirely commercial celebration because the faith origins are left out of it. The other countries that do spend more are, I believe it was some of the Scandinavian countries, but I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly.
No problem. So let's finish up with some of the things that you like to do on your Christmas traditions. Are there certain types of music or foods that come to mind during this period of time for you?
Well, when we decorate our Christmas tree, I like to make sure that we turn on some Bing Crosby Christmas, because that's what I liked when I was little. And my three daughters, just they decorate the tree. And I love being able to bring those same rituals to them each year, make sure they happen, because they look forward to them. And I think that it's part of what makes a family really secure, in that they can count on traditions and rituals that, you know, they're safe rituals, they're fine, and they're enjoyable. So, you know, we do that. I also like, not that we listen to it as a family so much, but we sing it sometimes at church, as I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, which is a poem by Longfellow. It's just a really moving message, I think, about Christmas time. But it's not quite so merry as the, it's more joyful, I guess, at the end than, you know, kid version merry. I also really like what I've learned about the European gift bringers. So I have a little corner of my house that I decorate with the Nyssa and some of the European characters, Father Christmas type, who, even if they look a little bit more like Santa now, they remind me that, you know, of the unique nature of Christmas before the global Christmas. And so those Icelandic Yule lads and their mother, Grilla, that they just look so, I think they're just really cool, so I like them. But I also enjoy making cookies and decorating and going to some of the little local things we have around here in Pennsylvania, like live nativities. And I'm hopefully this Friday going to a trombone choir playing around a bonfire at the German History Museum to just see what that was like, more of a 19th century celebration.
Yeah. Some of these traditions that we developed that are not only celebrated around the world, but very personalized traditions are one of the things that I cherish the most about this season. And we ourselves have a different ornament every year to represent something in our history from that previous year. And when we're decorating the tree, it's a great time to reflect upon the past year and years gone by too. And that's one of the memories or one of the traditions that I cherish the most. My guest today has been Tara Moore. She is the author of Victorian Christmas in Print and Christmas, the Sacred to Santa. You can find more about those on our website. We'll have links to them. Tara, thanks for being on Research on Religion, and Merry Christmas.
Oh, Merry Christmas to you and to all of your listeners.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.